welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
And this is Nick.
And this is another Secret War Saturday. We're going to be talking about three of the after Secret War tie-ins. One more week of these three books. Next week, we're going to be talking about 11 or 12 issues of The Thing. As those that read along with Secret Wars or have read it previously remember, Ben Grimm stayed back on the planet when all the other heroes left. And so for a year at his solo title, it all took place on Battleworld. So we're going to be talking about that next week. And then the following week, which is June 2nd, we're going to dive into Secret Wars 2. And apologies to Nick ahead of time. It just doesn't quite... I haven't read it in many, many years. I don't think it quite holds up. I mean, it wasn't as good to begin with. So my guess is it probably doesn't hold up as well. And, you know, prior to this rereading of Secret Wars that we just did, which is probably my fourth or fifth time reading Secret Wars, I've only ever read Secret Wars 2 once. Like, as each issue came out monthly, I didn't even go back when all eight issues were out and reread them all together in one reading. So that'll tell you kind of the quality of the story in a way. So,
oh boy.
Yeah. All right. So the three books we're going to talk about today, we have The Incredible Hulk 295. We have The Uncanny X-Men 181.
Yeah.
And also Amazing Spider-Man 252, which some of you may remember as the debut of the black costume. Because even though the origin and how it plays out happens in Marvel Superhero Secret Wars number 8, 252 came out before that. So, and as I'm going through and telling you the numbers, I now realize what... Before we started recording, he's like, of course you know what my favorite is. And I was... like, do I? Maybe we'll talk about that in the podcast. I was leaning toward X-Men 181 just because it's so different than any of the other tie-ins. And then as I'm looking at the cover of Amazing Spider-Man 252, I realize, oh yeah, Venom fan here. So clearly that's Nick's favorite. So we're going to start there. Amazing Spider-Man 252. The cover is kind of iconic, right? It's very, very much a homage to Amazing Spider-Man 1, but with him wearing the black costume rather than the red and blue, as we've come to recognize. And the creative team on the issue is... There it is. It's written by... Well, the plot is by Roger Stern. The script is by Tom DeFalco. We've got pencil breakdowns by Ron Frenz. Finished art by Brett Breeding. Colors by Glynis Ween. So the issue opens up with J. Jonah Jameson and Robbie Robertson talking about the fact that the heroes are still missing. And as we turn to the splash page, we see the, much like we did in the Avengers and the Fantastic Four that we talked about last week, we see the construct, I guess you'd call it, that the heroes were teleported by. We see that reappear. And Spider-Man leaps out, holding Kurt Connors, and they have, in fact, returned to Earth. So the police that are there, we saw that previously last episode, or last Secret War episode anyway, that the police were kind of guarding those areas where the machinery had been, and they put up barricades and everything. So when Spider-Man and Kurt Connors appear, the police are very surprised. And being that Spider-Man has a new costume, they don't necessarily recognize him, you know, because he's got the black and white costume. So Spider-Man goes and tries to retrieve his clothes that he left in a tree nearby. But birds and squirrels and such have gotten to them. And all he's able to get is his wallet and his keys and his camera. Oh, I'm sorry. Just wallet and keys. He actually had his camera with him. That's right. So again, we see the ability of the costume to kind of read his thoughts as it kind of opens a pocket for him and he sticks his wallet and keys there and then it closes up around him. And he's like, man, I'll never get used to that. So he swoops up Kurt Connors, drops him off with his wife and son, and then swings off home. And as soon as he drops in through his skylight of his apartment, again, we see the costume manifesting intelligence. And you just kind of wonder, I mean, Parker's a pretty smart guy. You would think he'd realize that this is like not a normal thing for, because he's not even consciously thinking, hey, I want to be in regular clothes. The costume's almost like reading his subconscious, and it transforms into like black jeans and a black t-shirt. And we see Peter looking a little worse for the wear, little 5 o'clock shadow, starts thinking that, you know, he hasn't shaved in days, and that makes him realize that he hasn't talked to his aunt in days. I've been gone over a week. So he calls up Aunt May. She invites him over to dinner. He's thinking, okay, things aren't bad. Let me give my girl Black Cat, Felicia Hardy, a call. Calls her up. She doesn't answer. And so he's thinking, well, let me go out and get some food. I'm pretty hungry. And no sooner does he leave the apartment than Felicia Hardy shows up, looks around. He's still not there. She's feeling kind of sorry for herself. She's like, I really need to talk to him. You know, she very much at this point of the Black Cat's history, she really feels dedicated to Spider-Man and feels like she's in love with him and they're meant to be. But part of what she feels like is keeping them apart is the fact that she doesn't have superpowers and she can't necessarily hold her own running around with Spider-Man. So she actually just recently, while Spider-Man was gone, made a deal with the Kingpin to gain some superpowers. And so she's worried about that and she wants to speak with Peter, but he's not there. So she runs off. And of course, as she runs off, he returns. You know, it's the old cliche. And as Peter's thinking, man, I got some bills to pay after checking his mail. No sooner does he think that than his camera literally pops out of his crotch where he had his door. I mean, literally just pop. He's like, my camera. My costume must have known I wanted it. So again, you just have to wonder, like, dude, this is not a normal thing. And he did think to himself earlier in the issue, I really need to go get this costume checked out by Reed Richards, as he offered to do back on Battleworld. But first things first, let's pay some bills. He goes into his dark room, develops the film, starts thinking about how crazy all these pictures look, and then realizes, who am I kidding? Everybody's going to think these pictures are fake. They're way too fantastic. All the heroes had agreed ahead of time that they weren't going to share any of what publicly happened out there on Battleworld because it would scare people. And this is actually kind of clever what Marvel editorial did here, right? So, you know, we talked about it a lot in these episodes, how the heroes disappeared in one issue and then they reappeared the following issue. But meanwhile, Secret Wars was taking 12 months to actually happen. So when Secret Wars ends, Amazing Spider-Man is on like 262 or 263. But we don't find out anything that actually happened because all the heroes signed it an NDA before they left Battleworld. So it was a way for Marvel to keep publishing and not spoil Secret Wars. So kind of interesting that's what they decided to do. So Peter decides he's going to destroy all the prints and the negatives because he can't sell these pictures, and they agreed not to talk about Battleworld. I think it's the first rule of Battleworld. The first rule of Battleworld is you do not talk about Battleworld.
What's the second rule of Battleworld?
You do not talk about Battleworld, Nick.
That sounds right.
And I think the third rule of Battleworld is if you go to Battleworld, you have to battle. So Pete tries to hit the hay. But he's restless, tossing and turning, just got too much on his mind. And again, costume reading his mind, and he had it draped over the back of his desk chair. It literally slithers over across the ground. And again, I just got to think, like, even if it's some kind of smart costume, it's not going to – the way it slithers, you got to think, man, this thing's alive, right? But anyway, it slithers over. It covers him, and Pete goes out web-slinging. And as it often does, as we've seen in the past in Spider-Man's history, it definitely clears his head. So he stops a mugger, and the muggy, the guy that's being mugged, is frightened by the black and white costume and starts yelling for the police. And Peter's like, well, some things never change. And then he comes across a couple arguing and decides that maybe they need to clear their heads too. So he takes them without asking. He just randomly grabs them and takes them web-slinging, gives them a bird's-eye view of the city, which seems to do wonders for Pete and kind of clear his head. Not sure it worked for these two lovebirds, but the issue ends with a splash page. It says, your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man in all his glory of black costume. But I don't know. I guess from what I'm understanding, and in no way do I have anything to base this on other than the way the panel is laid out on that splash page. He's like swinging toward, you know, because often Peter would place his camera somewhere and then like battle in front of it. So it would take the automatic pictures, right? And that's how he made his money. Based on the layout of this panel, he's swinging towards his camera so that he can get a shot of himself in his new costume to sell it. That's why it looks the way it does. Because, I mean, literally the building in the background is like curved, like it's being seen through like a fisheye lens.
Do you know? Well, there's an editor's note there that this is actually a sneaky way of giving you a bonus pinup of the web head. So it's purely to have a cool image for people to put on their fridge.
No, I saw the editor's note, and I wonder, you know, it makes sense. Hey, let's fit, but I mean, the perspective doesn't make sense though. Like when you actually look at it. So, I don't know. I mean, we could have got just as cool of a image and still had perspective be normal, like on the cover, for example. So. Anyway, I know you're a giant Venom fan, so let's hear your thoughts on the issue, Nick.
Well, I've never read any pre-Venom issues. The only one I've read that was him in the black suit was the one where he strips off the black suit in the church, and it falls on Brock. So I was pretty excited to read this issue, and I assume they knew where they were going with this at this point, right? Even though they switched to a regular black suit for a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it only makes sense. Again, I mean, this issue came out the same month as Secret Wars 2, right? So we're still another 6 months away from him actually – we see him actually getting the costume in Secret Wars number 8. So, yeah, I had to think that they knew this was going to happen. What I don't know is, so did they have an idea for this to go down, for him to have some kind of alien costume before Secret Wars? And then they were like, oh, wait, yeah, he's going to be on this alien world. We'll give him the costume then. Or did they have some idea? Yeah, I mean, I just don't know. Some rumors I've heard have said, well, the artists were getting tired of drawing the webs. And I've actually heard, like, Spider-Man is, like, honestly, one of the hardest characters to draw. Jim Lee, like, one of the greatest artists of this generation, right, hates drawing Spider-Man. And he'll tell you why. It's because of the webs. Like, they've got to line up. They've got to be symmetrical. They've got to be evenly spaced. It just takes forever.
Draw Deadpool.
Yeah, exactly.
Spider-Man without the webs.
Well, that's part of the reason that Rob Liefeld, he created him as a joke because, you know, he's friends with McFarlane. And McFarlane was constantly having to draw Spider-Man with all these webs. And, yeah, Liefeld's like, this is how you do it, dude. Same costume, just, you know, no webs. But I obviously give him some pouches because, you know, Rob Liefeld.
That affects the movies too. Well, I work a day job at a movie theater, and just today, Deadpool 2 comes out tonight. And just today, I got a call being like, "You guys have the new Spider-Man movie tonight?" I'm like, "Oh, you mean Deadpool? Yeah, we got that." So it's carried over into the movies. I think it's the eye shape is part of it. Like, kids see the Deadpool standee and are like, "Spider-Man," and the parents are like, "No, not for you." Like,
wow.
It's very similar. It's similar enough that kids and general audiences in the theater think it's the same.
Somebody called and asked if you had the new Spider-Man. And when you said Deadpool, they're like, oh, yeah, I meant Deadpool.
He's like, that's what I meant. Because I said, do you mean Avengers? Because Spider-Man's in that. And he's like, no, it's not that one. And I'm like, oh, Deadpool. And he was like, yeah, that one.
Yeah, because Spider-Man and Deadpool, they're so similar. Jeez. All right, what else? Any other thoughts about 252?
Well, I don't know. Since I don't know how much it was planned in advance or not, I don't know if it's me reading into it too much or if it's foreshadowing, but I love the mood swings that Parker has. Obviously, the suit crawling over him is part of Venom's origin, but I think even him overreacting to after he prints the image and he like crushes it in his hand, he's like, everyone will think these pictures are faked, or this other, he's super excited to be home, which could be a Peter Parker characteristic, or it could be a characteristic of the suit boosting all of his, like, I feel great. I feel more powerful than ever. And oh, now I'm super angry because of the suit. And I don't know if I'm reading into it too much. And it even like puts him in like a cool suit. Like it's now 80s Peter Parker where he's all black and he has some, they explain the beard he has, but it's still like, oh, look at Peter Parker. He came back cool. In the prequel issues, he was like wearing like a tank top and now he's like,
yeah, he's got some black. He's got the Miami Vice double going on, and yeah, pretty interesting. And I totally missed that little outburst of thinking that, yeah, that perhaps has to do with the costume.
Because normally he doesn't get that emotional. Yeah. Like, I don't see Peter Parker freak out that much normally in the current comics.
Right. It makes a lot of sense. And I think we see that more. I think we see the costume start affecting him more as it moves forward. So, yeah, I mean, pretty enjoyable issue. Again, Nick and I have talked. I don't know if we've done it on the podcast, but we've talked before about doing a Venom reading order. You know, like put it on the list of all the other things that we want to do. A Brian Michael Bendis reading order, which would be like, 2,000 books, and we want to do a Venom reading order and Irredeemable, and we'll definitely put it on the list and hopefully at some point be able to find time to do that. So I also feel like this book out of the three that we're reading tonight was the most kind of self-contained. The other two, you really get like quite the wait, what? You really kind of want to read the next one, even though the next issues aren't on the reading order. So, but yeah, all in all, it's an iconic issue, more so for the cover and just the fact that it is the first appearance of this black costume, more so than what happens inside. I'd say it's an iconic storyline though. The saga of the alien symbiote or whatever you want to call it. But as far as like action or momentous events happening in this issue, not so much. I'm sure at the time when it came out, it felt more momentous to have this new costume and to see him swinging around in it. But again, in the order we're reading it, and obviously we've read plenty of stories of Spider-Man in the black costume, doesn't quite have the same impact as it would have back then reading it off the stands. And I actually wasn't reading Amazing Spider-Man at the time when this came out. And I don't think I've ever owned a copy of Amazing Spider-Man 252, interestingly enough. All right, let's move on to the next book we're going to talk about. What do you want to talk about? You want to talk about X-Men or Hulk?
Hulk's queued up next, so let's do Hulk.
Let's do Hulk. Okay, so number 295, give you the creative team real quickly here. It's Bill Mantlo. This is in the middle of his long run on the Hulk. And we've got art by Sal Buscema and Danny Bolinati with colors by Bob Sharon. So as we saw in the Secret War miniseries, Hulk got hurt. He still has like a brace on his foot and a crutch. And much like the rest of the heroes, he reappears in Central Park. The construct is there, bright, blinding flash, and he reappears. And he's just angry. You know, we saw throughout the series, the Secret War miniseries or maxi series, how he was kind of losing his ability to think as Bruce Banner as the series went on, and we saw more and more of a return of the Savage Hulk. So that theme kind of continues here. We see Hulk says he snarls, the Hulk does, trying to retain those memories, trying to fathom what they meant to him and to the fate of the world for which he fought. So he's limping along through Central Park. He sees an elderly couple. Oh, Mary, isn't that the Hulk? Oh, well, I think you're right, Daniel. It is. I recognize him from that time story. He's a hero now. Yes, he's done so much good. And as the Hulk walks by and just backhands the old man, knocking him down, rawr, out of my way. Clearly, this is not the reasonable, rational Bruce Banner Hulk that we've seen in recent issues of the Hulk. But even that, we were starting to see a change already before he was spirited away to Battle World. So as the couple looks on, kind of horrified, thinking, I thought this guy was a hero, Hulk leaps away, starts remembering what was going on before he left. And it's basically a flashback to the previous issue where he had cured a dog that was dying of cancer for a family with gamma radiation. It was some experiments that Bruce Banner was doing to try to harness gamma rays to heal the sick and injured. which it's really interesting that Matt Lowe chose to tell this story, because it kind of goes hand in hand with the Hulk TV show, the original TV show with Bill Bixby and Lou Ferrigno, where it was Bruce Banner was working on medical stuff, as opposed to his origin in the comic, which was, you know, testing gamma bombs for weapons. So Matt Lowe takes a page out of the TV series here, and Banner experiments on this dog. He's able to heal the dog, even though as a side effect, the dog turns green because, you know, gamma rays, because apparently gamma rays are green, except not really, but in Marvel world they are. And the Hulk also remembers that his girlfriend got kidnapped by the contract killer Boomerang, because a gangster wanted to be cured. He was dying of cancer as well. He heard about the experiments, and the gangster goes by the name Max Hammer, basically held the kidnapping of Banner's girlfriend over his head and said, "Hey, cure me or we're going to hurt Kate." The Hulk complied, and Max Hammer kept his promise, told Hulk that Kate was being held in his penthouse. But before Hulk could get there, that's when he was transported to Battleworld. So as Banner leaps away from Central Park, he's recalling all this, goes to a phone, finds out where Max Hammer's penthouse is, heads over there to rescue her. Boomerang's just chilling, thinking, "Hey, I got a call from my boss. You're free to go. You're not going to be hurt. Just, you know, have to wait for your boyfriend to show up and, you know, it'll be smooth sailing." Obviously, the Hulk doesn't know this. He just arrives and proceeds to beat the crap out of Boomerang, nearly killing him. The police have to intervene to keep the Hulk from killing Boomerang. And the police officers realize, like, dude, this guy is supposed to be like a hero. He's supposed to have been pardoned now and be on our side. But they're just not quite sure what to make of him. He seems very angry, ready to attack the police themselves. When Kate shows up and she says, "No, I'm Dr. Catherine Waynesboro, Dr. Banner's associate. Come to take him home." And the cops remark, "Man, talk about Beauty and the Beast." So now that Hulk Banner is with Kate, he seems to calm down a little bit, and they head back to his laboratory. In the meantime, he actually turns back into Banner. And when he arrives at the laboratory, there's a giant line of people, and Banner's like, "What's going on?" And the people are like, "We're being healed by this gamma procedure." And there's people coming out the other side saying, "I can walk, I can see, my cancer's gone." And Banner's like, "What the heck are you doing? You don't understand." And some of the people are really angry. They're like, "What do you mean? Wait your turn. You can't tell us what to do. Who the heck are you?" And Banner's like, "Me? I'm the one you've all come to see. This is my home, my laboratory. I'm Bruce Banner, the Hulk." And he transforms back into the Hulk, says, "Get out of my way." And Kate again tries to calm him down. He's like, "These people are just suffering. They're trying to get help." And Banner Hulk says, "Oh, of course, Kate, you're right. I can stop this madness. I'll help them. That's what heroes are supposed to do." And he jumps through the top of the observatory, and he actually finds Max Hammer there, the gangster that he cured, and he's the one that's basically handing out the cure. So what's interesting is Hammer talks about the fact that he could have charged people an arm and a leg, you know, how much would you pay for your life, basically, to cure them. But he feels like not only did the procedure cure him of his cancer, it cured him of crime. And he's doing this out of the quote-unquote goodness of his heart. He's sharing the cure that Banner has. And Banner's like, "Dude, you don't understand what you're doing. We don't know what the potential side effects could be. It's why I was taking things slow. We just don't know." And then we have a voice off panel that says, "You're wrong, Dr. Banner. I know." And it's the father of the family whose dog had been cured. And he tells the story of how the dog was fine when they first brought it home, but then gradually it became more and more aggressive. It bit one of the children. He eventually had to chain it up in the basement. And in the middle of the night, it broke free, broke through the door, was about to attack the family. And only because he kept a loaded revolver in the house and was able to shoot the dog, did he prevent the dog from killing his family. And so Banner says, "This is why I was so cautious, why I wanted to proceed slowly. I knew how dangerous gamma rays could be. Lord, they made me a monster." And meanwhile, the rest of the people that were in the laboratory who have just been cured are kind of beside themselves. They're like, oh my God, what's going to happen to us? They're very, very worried. And the one who's worried most of all, because despite him being cured of cancer and supposedly crime, he's still a very selfish person at heart. And that's Max Hammer. And he's like, I don't understand. You know, the newspapers said the days of the Hulk being a monster were over. I thought this was safe. I just wanted a cure. I thought you had everything under control. And basically the stress of Max Hammer finding out that he could turn into a monster, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. He kind of collapses behind some equipment. And when he stands back up, we see he's clearly Savage Max Hammer now. He's very much a Hulk version. And the caption says, once there was a man cursed by his own genius whom fate chose to make a monster. It took years for Bruce Banner to redeem himself, to reverse his misfortune, and seek to start benefiting his world. But today, all his hopes and aspirations and successes melt away like a snowflake in the sun. So just like we've seen Banner himself lose control and become more and more Savage Hulk-like, his dreams of being a benefit to mankind and being seen as a hero are kind of deteriorating as well. So this is really the beginning of the end for the Hulk downward spiral. This part of the Hulk mythos that Matt Lowe is telling, he brought Hulk up high with the recent pardon and having Hulk be able to retain the intelligence of Banner. But, you know, as high as that high was, maybe as high as the Hulk has ever been in his history, feeling like a hero, he brings him super, super low. Eventually, the story, not to spoil it too much, you know, comic that's 20 plus years old, storyline that's 20 plus years old. But, I mean, Banner eventually becomes completely subsumed. It's almost like the pendulum had swung one way and allowed the Banner persona to rule over the Savage persona for so long that then it swings back the other way to compensate. And the Hulk as a savage machine of destruction, if you will, kind of takes over, and some of the heroes have to eventually banish him to a different realm just so that he won't like destroy everything in his path. So as I said, it's a very tragic time in the Hulk history. So but just like I said, I mentioned this when we were talking about The Amazing Spider-Man. That was very much the most self-contained story, because this ends right here on this cliffhanger with the Hulk looking like he's about to do battle with the Max Hammer Hulk. So what were your thoughts on – well, one more thing before I ask you, Nick. I do notice there next month, Rom the Healer. So even though I wasn't reading Hulk at the time, I'd pick it up now and then. I did pick up that the next issue because it had Rom Space Knight on the cover, and I'm a huge Rom Space Knight fan. I think at this time, Rom was one of the few comics I was picking up every single month and never missed an issue. Sal Buscema art as well. So I fondly remember the cover and the story. And for years, I hadn't read this one. I hadn't read 293. So I kind of understood what was going on because, you know, comics at this time always did kind of the flashback, so you'd know what was going on with the storyline. But yeah, it made a lot more sense when I finally went back and did a Hulk read, and I'm like, oh yeah, this is where Rom comes in and kind of saves the day, kind of not. But yeah, pretty interesting. What are your thoughts on Hulk 295?
Well, what was Bruce Banner thinking in the first place? I thought that's when I read the issues before this. Sending home a dog without monitoring it for a while. That's ridiculous.
Yeah,
hasn't he ever read a Hulk comic? I mean, come
science.
On.
That's science. That's medicine in the mid-80s, man. We, you know, Manny and I actually talked about this when we read the prelude to Secret Wars, the prelude issue. I guess it was 294. And there might even have been two. It might have been 293 and 294. But yeah, we talked about it. We're like, wait, so he cures the dog and then he's with the dog for like 2 minutes and says, all right, take the dog home. No testing, no, just, yep, he's cool. Take the dog home.
Yeah, Banner's worse than Stark in this case. Normally Stark's the worst, but also, is Max Hammer related to Justin Hammer anyway, or are those just two separate characters?
No. I wondered that myself, and I also wondered if if Max Hammer
was not AIM,
was like an, or, like an old school Marvel gangster from like way, way back in the 60s or something. I had never heard of him before and I didn't bother to look him up. So don't know. I mean, interesting that they have the same name. So, yeah.
I guess when there's that many issues of a book, though, you're going to reuse a last name, even if it's an important last name, like Hammer Industries.
It's possible.
And then the final question, what was it? I had three things to say about this book.
Let me look up Max Hammer.
Oh, Boomerang. Yeah, so this guy isn't a captain or like a doctor or anything. This guy's just Boomerang.
He's just Boomerang, man. He's
not even Doctor or Mr. Boomerang.
Nope.
Not even Mr. Boomerang.
Nope. He's just Boomerang.
And okay, honestly, those were my main thoughts.
And honestly, you wonder how he could have survived based on the. I mean, he doesn't have any superpowers.
I thought of that. Like when, especially when he like bashes him right on the head. It says he like bends his head just in time, but it's like that would have broke his neck instead of his skull.
Yeah. Okay. So I just looked it up. Max Hammer, Earth 616 appearances. He appears in Hulk 294, 295, 296, and 297. And that's it. So yeah, he hadn't appeared before, hasn't appeared since. So yeah, I think Matt Lowe just created him for this series.
We'll just say they're related somehow.
So yeah, and if you listeners are curious where I found that information so quickly, MarvelWikia.com. It is your friend.
Good plug.
I just used Marvel Wikia earlier, and we'll talk about that when we talk about the next issue, which is Uncanny X-Men 181, Young Dragons in Love. So let me give you the creative team really quickly here. Written by Chris Claremont. Wonderful pencils by John Romita Jr. Inks by Dan Green. And colors by Glynis Wien. So there's not a whole heck of a lot to this story. It starts out, we see some Japanese children saying, "Look, up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's a dragon." And we see Tokyo Story is the name of the story, and we see a giant green dragon. And as the Japanese children, not to be stereotypical at all open their quote-unquote monster books to look at all these silhouettes of different monsters or gaijin that they clearly carry around with them at all times, because you never know when Japan is going to be attacked by a giant monster. But the silhouette is not there, and they realize they've discovered a brand new monster. Wait till they tell all the other kids at school. They'll be so jealous. And as they're looking up at the dragon, we see a bright light, and some people popped out of nowhere just like the dragon, and they're falling, and they crash to the ground, and they look like they've been in a fight, and they recognize them because they are in their monster book. It's the X-Men! And where did the wind come from that then blows the children off their feet? Well, the dragon is flying off. So the kids go over, they check on the X-Men, they offer their hot tea to the X-Men. And the X-Men kind of get their bearings. They're all accounted for except for the other dragon that flew back at the last instant, entered their little teleportation area, and we saw that bright blinding flash at the end of Secret Wars 12. And also Cyclops is not accounted for. We know that when the X-Men teleported from Central Park in 180, Cyclops wasn't with them, but Cyclops did show up. He was actually on his honeymoon. So it seems fair to think that perhaps he got teleported back to where he came from. Somehow Richards' use of the technology supposedly was going to send everyone back where they came from. The X-Men themselves remark on that, and then they realize, well, it must have been some kind of interference with the dragon flying in at the last moment, and Cyclops is probably back where he belongs, but we're in Japan, and we can't just go home. Because it's our responsibility to track down, because they hear from the children about this big giant dragon, but they're also worried about Kitty Pryde, who last known to them was going to accompany Doug Ramsey, who eventually becomes Cypher. Kitty was going to accompany Doug Ramsey to the Hellfire School, but the X-Men know that the Hellfire School is really a front for the Hellfire Club. Well, actually, I shouldn't say the Hellfire School. I should say the Massachusetts Academy, which is a private school, much like Xavier's School for Gifted Children. And just like Xavier's School is a front for the X-Men, the Massachusetts Academy is a front for the Hellfire Club. So the X-Men know that Kitty was kind of walking into danger, but they thought they were going to be, you know, on planet and available for her if they needed help. You know, being that they're in New York, Massachusetts, not that far, they could get to her if she needed, you know, she was supposed to stay in telepathic contact with Professor X. But being that they've been gone for so long, you know, a little over a week, they're pretty worried. So Professor X sends Rogue, because she's the one that can get back the fastest, to check on Kitty, check on Colossus, check on Cyclops rather, and determine if there's anything going on there that the X-Men should know about, while the remaining X-Men deal with this dragon, because they're pretty worried once they hear from the children that this dragon was a giant-sized creature, because everything they saw on the planet, the dragon was very small, much like Lockheed. There is a little bit of tension between Storm and Professor X, and Wolverine thinks to himself, you know, Professor X is coming on strong, and conflict of command is never good for a team. And he understands why Professor X is doing it now that he has the use of his legs back. He's, you know, kind of feeling pretty good about himself, and he's always been a leader, a de facto leader in a way, but now he's got the ability to lead on the field. But at the same time, you know, Rogue has kind of turned over a leaf recently and become much more of a, not a soft character, you know, but much less of an emotional character, much more angry, much more on edge. This is kind of her 80s punk mohawk era. You know, she's not quite the Mother Earth character she was before. And Wolverine feels like when Cyclops left and Storm became the leader, that's when Storm started to maybe overcompensate. And it's when this her tough interior started to become her tough exterior. And with Professor X causing a conflict of command, it's not really fair to her because she did sacrifice so much, even in a way changing her personality and the way she sees the world. And if Professor X does take over the leadership of the X-Men, it's going to be like Storm made that sacrifice for nothing. So it's pretty interesting that Wolverine, of all people, has these kind of thoughts. And it's a stark contrast to the way that Shooter wrote the character. Shooter writes Wolverine very two-dimensional in that 12-issue Secret Wars series, and we talked about that a lot, especially in the early issues. Claremont makes him much more of a thinking man's warrior, which I really prefer, and I think makes a lot more sense when you sit back and think about just how long-lived Wolverine is and how much conflict and battle he's seen. If there's anybody who understands leadership and different leadership styles and personality and the human condition, it would be somebody like Wolverine, who's been through so much, you know, lived as a savage himself for a while, and has just seen so much history, both the good man at his best and man at his worst. So meanwhile, the Japanese air defense picks up the dragon on radar. They send out the tanks, they send out the airplanes, and apparently they're surprised to see this monster because, and I quote, "It can't be, this is off season." So apparently there's a season of monsters that where monsters attack Japan in the Marvel Universe, coming from Monster Island. I wasn't necessarily aware of this, and don't recall that from the 80s, but I don't know. Maybe they're just referring to Godzilla movies. I really don't know. It seems very comical and strange to me. But meanwhile, the dragon is causing damage in downtown Tokyo, and the X-Men go on the attack. But before they can really even do anything to the dragon, that they're kind of forced into rescue duty, with Colossus kind of batting away some debris, Storm deflecting debris away with her elemental powers, Nightcrawler teleporting people away from falling debris. Meanwhile, Storm suggests that Professor X attempt to communicate telepathically with the dragon. And he attempts to, and he finds out that the dragon's thoughts are very orderly, but the dragon mistakes this psychic probe as an attack and launches a giant chunk of building at him. And it probably would completely pulverize Professor X, but Sunfire shows up, and although he blasts the debris, he can't, he doesn't completely obliterate it, and the debris ends up falling on Professor Xavier and kind of burying him partially. Meanwhile, the jets have arrived, and they, even though it does no damage, they fire on the dragon, just trying to force it away from the populated area. Likewise, the tanks are firing. Again, it does no damage. It's inconsequential to the dragon. And as the X-Men look on, they're like, man, the dragon's just getting mad and not taking much damage. And as we turn the page, we get an interlude, and we see that Cyclops does indeed reappear in Tahiti. He apparently was on his honeymoon when he was spirited away to Battleworld. And Madeline Pryor, his wife, is eventually happy to see him, but then gets kind of huffy that he was gone for so long and she thought he was dead. And he apologizes and she cries and they make up. And never was a fan of Madeline Pryor, very, very much a two-dimensional character. Meanwhile, back in Japan, the dragon is continuing to do damage with a sweep of its wings. It blows away the tanks, sends skyscrapers swaying, and Storm attempts to control the wind storm that the dragon's creating with its wings. But it's beyond her ability to really control, and she gets kind of tossed way up in the air and loses consciousness. Meanwhile, Professor X, we see he lost consciousness as well. And as he comes to, he kind of panics because he thinks that he's paralyzed again as he's buried in this debris. And Professor X is like, hey, dude, calm down. Wolverine, rather, is like, hey, Charlie, calm down. Your psychic screams that are going to turn our heads inside out. You're not hurt that bad. And I'm looking out for people who are hurt way more than you. But Colossus comes to dig the professor out as Wolverine finds a mother and a child and rescues the child. But the mother basically dies in Wolverine's arms as Wolverine makes a promise to the mother that he will keep the daughter, Emiko, safe. And he gives his word, and I'm pretty sure that Emiko is a character that shows up again, although I'm not 100% on that. I didn't Marvel Wikia her, so maybe I should do that in a minute. Meanwhile, the dragon kind of flies off as Sunfire rescues Storm from the fall she's about to take. And the dragon kind of swats at them both, and they fall to the ground. They're okay, but just kind of stunned. And then as the dragon's about to attack them as they lay there stunned, Lockheed pulls in front of the dragon and communicates in whatever way they communicated on the planet. And the dragon's very taken aback by that. And Lockheed, you know, shoots out his fire breath at the dragon. And even though it's inconsequential as far as doing physical damage, the dragon reels away. It says, more in shock than actual pain. She can't believe this is happening. How could Lockheed treat her so when she had given him her hearts? She never realized that was a gift he didn't want, or he didn't ask for nor desired. So, you know, again, it's the whole young dragons in love. I guess much like Johnny Storm on the planet, Lockheed was just looking for a good time while he was there. And now that he's back home, doesn't want anything to do with her. So the dragons fly off, and the scene switches back to Japanese Air Command. And as they're both flying, there's a flash on the screen, and the dragons are gone. They've disappeared. So the X-Men are handling their wounded, both Emiko, the young girl that Wolverine rescued, as well as helping Professor X. And as they meet up with Sunfire and Storm, Lockheed shows up as well. And Professor X says, you know, I can't read Lockheed's thoughts any more than anyone else. He's truly alien. Perhaps Kitty is the only one that has a chance of understanding him. But he really did kind of save the day. And there's a panel there where he's got his arms crossed and he's looking pretty smug. And Wolverine remarks, well, you know, it was violent and he tore Tokyo apart. But love makes you do crazy things. So, you know, you do what you do. Then there's an epilogue, Senator Robert Kelly discussing his Mutant Affairs Control Act, which leads into, you know, the mutant fear-mongering and all that storyline that Claremont basically tells over the next 3 or 4 years in Marvel Comics. So I was curious enough, like, I had read this issue previously, and I always thought that there was like a resolution, like the other dragon got shrunk back down or something, like, or did he show back up? Like, all of a sudden he just disappears, or she, I should say. So that's why I was on Marvel Wikia earlier. I'm like, wait, what happened to this dragon? Like, I thought I remembered more of a resolution. So according to what I read on Marvel Wikia, the dragon committed suicide because Lockheed rejected her. Now, I didn't get that at all from the story. I don't know how you would, like, get that. It just all of a sudden – and the dragon's name is Puff, and it just goes up in a puff of energy, a puff of magical battle world energy or something. I don't know. Like, I didn't get that at all from the story. Didn't understand what happened at all. Not Claremont's finest hour. This is one of actually – in this long run of X-Men, this is one of my least favorite issues, like, of all time of X-Men that I've ever read. It's definitely like bottom five for me. I just didn't like it. Remedia's art is starting to get worse, like noticeably worse in my mind. His transition, it's not as bad as it gets or as bad as it is now. He's actually a little bit on the upswing now. I feel like he's already hit the rock bottom and he's kind of swinging back up. But it's getting there, man, where it's like I can't read comics that this guy draws. It's pretty bad in this issue, in my opinion. And yeah, the story just left me cold. That's all I'll say. What are your thoughts about it, Nick?
Well, wait. So everyone, all the heroes except for Cyclops actually walked into the arena thing, right?
Correct.
And dropped Cyclops back off at home. And almost all the villains were teleported there, as far as we know, if not all of them. But Dr. Connors came home with Spider-Man. He wasn't dropped into his house.
That's true.
That's due to the dragon, I suppose. Do we learn why they were dropped in Japan? Besides there being a dragon involved?
It's got to be the dragon. It's the only possible explanation.
I guess all the monsters are drawn to Monster Island.
Could have ended up anywhere in the entire galaxy when you think about it, if it's causing interference. But no, they just randomly hop from... you know, where they should have landed in Central Park, New York, to Japan, outside Tokyo. And Wolverine himself remarked, I can't stay out of this country no matter how hard I try.
He's obviously has a history with Japan, obviously.
Yeah, exactly.
Weird. Okay, yeah, I don't have a lot to say about this issue. I just thought it was strange.
Yeah. Bad. The word you're looking for is bad. Not strange.
Bad.
Bad, bad, bad. Bad. I'm gonna see Chris Claremont this weekend at Comic-Con Revolution in Ontario, and I'm gonna tell him how bad this issue is. Like, dude.
And what's the deal with Xavier being able to walk and the Hulk being smart? Is this like a reboot of like a mini like all new Marvel moment where it's like, look, old heroes are back in the action again, or different?
If I remember right, it was the Shi'ar, you know, that were finally able to help Charles walk again, like finally heal him with their advanced medical technology, but it doesn't last. Just like the Hulk, like I feel like the whole reason Matlow gave like managed to merge Hulk, like he was running out of ideas, so let's bring the Hulk like up high up here, you know, like let's make him like a hero in everybody's eyes just so I can tear him down again, you know, a way to cause conflict. Because prior to that, I don't know, for like a good 50 issues, maybe 5 years or so of Hulk, it was basically, again, kind of like the TV show. And Mantlo didn't write all that, but, you know, the TV show where he's constantly moving from place to place, real loner, you know, different villain every issue kind of thing. That was kind of the 50 issues before that. He was always on the run. Army was after him. Police were after him. And he'd randomly, you know, be in Egypt, and then he'd be in the Midwest, and then he'd be here and there and whatever, was moving all over the place. So I think Matlow was just running. He came on the book, wanted to add some stability, so Hulk wasn't running around from place to place. And brought him super high so then he could bring him down low. I'm not going to say anything to Chris Claremont about this issue. The guy's a legend.
I know you are.
The guy's a legend. He deserves all respect. It's just for me, it's not an issue that stands out in my mind except for being kind of bad. I mean, I think if you're a big fan are they called kaiju, like monsters or whatever?
Kaiju, yeah.
Then I think you'd probably be like, yeah, this is cool. You know, dragon and Japan and you know, and get to see some destruction and everything. But I don't know. And maybe it's the resolution, right? Maybe because it's so ambiguous that I had to go look it up on Marvel Wikia and read that, that Puff disappeared in a literal puff of Battle World energy. I don't know. Just really, really
strange. It was suicide. He puffed out of existence on purpose.
She puffed out of existence.
She. Oh, my God. So sad.
Yeah, makes it even worse, right? And then you throw on the Romita art. It's like maybe maybe with really, really cool art, I would have enjoyed it more as well. But yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to that's the last one. I was thinking there's one more. Nope, that's it.
That's all I read.
That's it. That's all the tie-in. So yeah, much like Hulk, where we're left with some threads, I don't think this one is as bad as the Hulk. Hulk kind of ends on a cliffhanger. Again, Spider-Man, obviously there are some plot threads with the alien costume going on still, but pretty much self-contained. Hulk, not self-contained at all. Cliffhanger. I'd say this one kind of falls in the middle, right? Like, we have resolution, even if we don't realize it necessarily, but the dragon did disappear. And you pick up the next issue and the dragon doesn't reappear. In fact, the X-Men don't even appear in the next issue. The next issue is all about Rogue and what happens to her when she gets back home. Like, complete Rogue spotlight. I think we get we get Ilyana Rasputin's voice on an answering machine. And I think that's it as far as other X-Men. And she's not even X-Men. She's a new mutant. But that's like it for the other appearances except for Rogue. So, and then the following issue, 183, is a very, very famous issue. Very, very good issue. One of my favorites of this run. And Colossus and Juggernaut battle in a bar in Manhattan. But that issue opens up and the X-Men are just back from Japan. It's just on the splash page. Colossus is there and Kitty Pryde is there and they're talking. And Colossus is like, oh, I fell in love on this alien world and blah, blah, blah. It's really cheesy or whatever. But the fight between Colossus and Juggernaut is completely epic. But you don't know that at the end of this issue, right? You don't know that they're eventually just going to – you're going to pick up the next issue. It's going to be all Rogue. And then the following issue, X-Men are just back. I mean, from our perspective, we're like, okay, the dragon situation looks like it's resolved. But we have no idea how the X-Men are going to get home. They're stuck in Japan. Like – is Charles Xavier hurt really bad? Is he okay? What's going to happen with Emiko? None of that matters. We'll just do an issue with Rogue, and then we'll move on. I don't know. Interesting. I mean, again, you don't know that at the time. So that's why I say this one feels like it's not quite all wrapped up in a nice, neat little bow. But I guess you figure it out pretty quick when you pick up 183, so... That's something else we should do is do a big long read of Claremont's X-Men run. Have you ever read any of that old classic X-Men stuff?
No, but I would.
Yeah, I mean, you want to talk about wordy. Him and Byrne, man. Byrne on Fantastic Four and Byrne on Thing and Claremont on... I mean, even at the time, like, you know how wordy some of these comics from the mid-80s can be, right?
Mm-hmm.
So even in that context, even among his contemporaries in the mid-80s, people would say... Man, Claremont really puts a lot of words on the page. We're talking about the mid-80s comics, and people are talking about Claremont putting a lot of words. You know he's using a lot of words if people are saying that. So, anyway, I think that's going to wrap it up for this episode of Secret Wars Saturday. Once again, we want to thank everybody for joining us. Don't forget, you can check out the show notes if you want to find the link to the chronology that we're following. Again, next episode's going to be basically the thing on Battleworld, that long run. It's about 11 or 12 issues. And then we'll be following up that the following weekend with Secret Wars 2, number one. So again, go and check it out in the show notes. And you can follow along with us. Read them ahead of time. Listen to what we have to say. Listen to what we have to say. Read them after. I do think there's worth and there's definitely entertainment in a lot of this old Marvel stuff. A lot of quality. And if you don't have the books, Secret Wars 2 books are relatively inexpensive. You know, it's not like Secret Wars 1 where you have like issue 8, first origin of the alien costume, whatever, can be really pricey. Issue 1 can be really pricey. Secret Wars 2, you can probably find them for a buck, if not less. You probably can find the whole run of 8 issues on eBay for like $10. Wouldn't surprise me at all. The other thing you could do is they're all available on Marvel Unlimited digitally if you want to go and check them out that way. So, yeah, they are really cheap. So are most of the tie-ins. I can't think of any Secret Wars 2 tie-in book that's worth more than a couple bucks here or there. So definitely go and check them out. Check out the chronology in the show notes and pick up the books if you'd like. So you can also go to lrmonline.com for all past episodes of the podcast. Twitter.com/thecomicsource is where we can be found on Twitter. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three places are great spots to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage, especially Instagram. Like, I'm going to be in Comic-Con Revolution this weekend in Ontario, California, and I'll be posting a bunch of pictures of cosplayers and the convention itself and artists and people I talk to on Instagram. So be sure you're following us there. While you're at lrmonline.com, you can also check out all our other coverage on pop culture, movies, TV shows, all that kind of good stuff. So thanks for listening, everybody. And we will talk to you next time.
Bye.